Blog Talk Radio. Hello, everybody. Glad you can join us on Wise Women Media Radio Show. We want to thank our sponsors, Hoodooed Blog, Here Be Monsters, Roundtree 7, and the Daughters of Isis. And we also want to thank Diane Nealon for being with us here tonight. I want to make sure that you all have her website before we even get started. You can see her website at www.hearus, one word, HEARUS.US. She is a homeless advocate and most recently has been working with youth and children. And we want to introduce Diane to you. And Diane, how are you doing tonight? And we want to thank you for being with us.
Oh, Anita, thanks for having me. I am doing well and just delighted to be a part of the show.
How close were you to the tornadoes up there in Indiana? Were you is that where you've been just recently?
No, actually, I'm in outside of Atlanta, Georgia, and was here as the storms were hitting. I actually have friends in the Indiana area that were very, very close, so I was following it there, and we were getting some storms here, but fortunately for folks in this area, we didn't get slammed, but it was close, and it was just a horrific unfolding of Mother Nature's destructive power. And I think it's just probably just the beginning of the season, from what I understand.
I wanted to let everybody know, because I had discussed it with you before we went on the air, about where that song came from. That's a song by Sinead O'Connor that was actually part of the soundtrack of a French movie called Le Premier Cri, The First Cry. The movie follows pregnant women all over the world as they live, work, and give birth. You can find this movie, you can find out all about this movie online. I do not know yet if you can actually view this movie online. I'd like to try to find it in any case, but fantastic vocals there by Sinead O'Connor. And
oh,
I thought
goodness,
the music was really fitting. Yeah, the music was very fitting to what we're going to be discussing. So let's get started with some questions. And the first one I wanted to ask you, which really isn't, I didn't see it on your website, but how did this become your calling, homeless children and homeless youth? How did you become driven to be working in this? And it's got to be a lot of times a thankless job and a thankless calling. And you are definitely a saint to be doing this. But what?
Thank you. It's actually, I mean, it's a funny thing. It's not, it's probably one of the more thankful jobs that I've ever had, and I mean that real sincerely. I get more hugs and more thank yous than most people in jobs that pay a lot more and seem to be more important to some people anyhow. So I have to just say, number one, I'm delighted that I'm doing what I'm doing, because I get way more gratitude than the average bear. I've actually been working in homelessness, on homelessness issues and with homeless people since the mid-80s, and it was one of those stumble-into kind of things that I didn't have in my career plan, not that I have much of a career plan, but and I started working for Catholic Charities in the Diocese of Joliet, and I was there just on a six-month assignment to help them do an accreditation self-study, and that's when homelessness really was hitting the Rust Belt areas, and there was no homeless shelter there. There were no resources there, and people were coming into our agency, and we provided some other emergency assistance like food and other things. But so I was just, my boss said, hey, you're the one that doesn't have 18,000 things on your plate, because I had just started there. He said, you deal with homelessness. And I'm just kind of looking at him like, I have a philosophy degree, but started using my philosophy degree in the sense of looking at the problems and possible solutions. So I started a shelter back in Joliet, in the mid-80s, and didn't really know what I was doing, but that has never stopped me. So I have been doing that type of work. I ran a shelter for 15 years from Joliet to Aurora, and then got involved in the systemic issues pertaining to homelessness and poverty, and realized what big holes there were as far as the laws that should protect people from things like homelessness and poverty, or at least should let kids into school despite their homelessness. And so I got involved in that back in the 90s, and I have to go. I'll go back to 1989. I can remember the day, October 8th, 1989. I was in Washington, D.C. with the Housing Now March, and we were talking to our beloved senator from Illinois, Paul Simon. And there was a small group of us from Illinois there, and we were standing in the hallway at the Senate office building, and he said, you know, we are not going to do anything about homelessness here in Congress until we start hearing from people on this issue, because that's not something that we hear from people about. And that just struck a chord. And I really can picture us standing there and me hearing that. And I thought, well, I want to change that. And so I got involved in a number of ways, is systemic advocacy policy change, and kind of blended that into my crazy life as a shelter director and haven't looked back since.
Wow. And I met you last year when you were traveling with Pat LaMarche, and I think it was the week I had moved into this house, so I was like...
Yeah, you were a little hectic, you were stressed and tired.
I was pretty crazed and chaotic, but I had no idea where I had packed my bras at that point. I remember we had done a talk at Sacred Grounds, and Pat, for those of you that don't know, traveled with Diane. I'm letting any listeners know that. And Pat now does a radio show up in Maine, but she's still pretty heavily entrenched in homeless advocacy as well. And she's been writing some amazing articles on Huffington Post.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
For anyone that wants to look her up on Huffington Post, she really gives the lowdown on homelessness. And you have your blog, which is invisible-homeless-kids.blogspot.com. I was just taking a look at that. That's really, really well done. And you go into not just homelessness, but legislation, and there's subcategories to the side, so you can actually go into the different labels and look up different topics under homelessness as well. So very nicely cataloged there. So
thank you.
Yeah, so anybody that wants to do any research, they can certainly go to that blog and get a lot of information. Tell us about the newest project, The Littlest Nomads.
Oh, The Littlest Nomads is going to be a heartbreaker when we're almost finished with it. It's a short film designed to, I'd say, rip the hearts out of people watching it. I have to be quite honest that I think if it doesn't rip your heart out, then you probably don't have one. It is showing the 0 to 5-year-old homeless kids and kind of taking an initial look at that population and why it's so absolutely horrific that, number one, that they are homeless, and number two, that nobody knows that they're homeless, and number three, that our government doesn't seem to be caring that much about it. So it is a short film that will be out. We're just about finished with it now, and you cannot watch it without crying.
Oh, yeah. I know, and I would. Now, is this going to be a documentary that's going to hit different movie theaters, or are we going to be able to get access to this movie right away so we can play it in our different communities?
You will be able to get access to it. It's going to be on our much-beloved DVD that we've been selling, My Own Four Walls, which is it's my first film, and I certainly want to give a huge amount of credit to Laura Vasquez, who is a film professor at NIU, that's Northern Illinois University, for those of you from other parts of the country. And Laura has, we've been working together since my first film, and she's been wonderful. But anyhow, so My Own Four Walls is the name of the film. If you go to the website, My Hear Us website, you'll see that. We're going to add that onto the DVD. No extra charge, because I think it will it'll bring kids, the 0 to 5-year-old kids, and then I interviewed 75 kids through my first trip around the country back in 2006, and those kids just talk about what it's like to be homeless and what school means to them, and it's a 20-minute film there that you can see a trailer on our website, and it's a keeper.
I wanted to discuss a little bit about some of the biggest obstacles for the littlest nomads, the smallest homeless victims. What are the biggest obstacles just in their lives? I can't think of any other way to categorize that? Is it healthcare? Is it shelter? What would be the hardest thing for a mother to be able to do when she's in a homeless state and she's bringing a child into the world and that child is homeless as well?
Oh, Anita, it's so sad, and I don't know where to start. And on one hand, there's a number of different ways people endure homelessness. Sometimes they do get into a shelter. Sometimes they're hopping from couch to couch to couch, just trying not to overstay their welcome in one place. Or they might be in some of these little sleazy no-tell motels on the outskirts of town. Or they might be in a shelter. So it's a, sort of depending on where they are. I mean, I've seen families with young babies, camping and not having a home and not having heat. And so their whole life just starts on the wrong foot. And these little babies, at the period of time when they are most in need of stability, nurturing, a positive environment, all of the things that will affect them for the rest of their lives. They are in a number, just a various stage of just, they are deprived of that. And it could be nutrition. There's a lot of sickness, so healthcare issues. The food is, a lot of times parents can't afford formula and breastfeeding is, not an option. And it's just these little babies start out without so much, diapers, and then it just gets worse. They're in environments where they can't really move around and crawl around, and they don't have a mother or a father that's holding them and cooing to them and doing the things that, make a difference as these little babies get older. So it's just a horrible way to start a life. And we have in this country, and my estimate is certainly not anything that, you're not going to hear any agreement in Congress, but there's probably 1 million little babies, 0 to 5 year old, 1 million in our country right now.
Wow.
A million little kids getting off on the wrong foot in life.
Oh. And I was just talking to the friend that I put you in touch with over the phone, just a local person here, and she was telling me in this county alone, they counted up just from the schools 300
mm-hmm.
children. This is a very small populated county here,
yeah.
And it's mostly rural. There
mm-hmm.
really isn't any large cities in this county. And a lot of farmland and everything. So 300 children would be a lot in this county, but that they're saying that they're only counting the tip of the iceberg. These are only the kids that are attending school.
Right.
So
there
may
probably half
not
of
attending
that.
And not in or they're not of age to go to school,
mm-hmm.
or they're homeschooled if they are in school.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, the numbers definitely would not be correct.
You can certainly know that there's hundreds of little kids, little babies, littlest nomads out there too.
Wow. It's just, and I think as far as for infants, and toddlers, I think probably one of the most difficult things would be access to health care for them.
Oh, certainly. You just look at what a little baby needs in life, and when they're in a homeless situation, you can pretty well count on that they don't have that.
Hmm.
And you just look at everything. I mean, diapers. How can
right.
you
diapers
ration
are
diapers?
Super.
Baby formula, which actually now our favorite big box store offers credit-worthy people a charge account so that you can afford the formula, which is, made by a company that uses bad soy and all that other kind of stuff that we just don't even want to get into. But it's like charge and pay interest on your baby's formula? Are you kidding?
Yeah, that's... Well, see, this big box store, we won't name it, but yeah, I'm sure anybody that's listening gets the gist of which store it is. They gotcha if you're poor. Because if you're poor and you don't have a credit, if you don't have credit and you can't use your bank account because you're overdrawn, or they closed your account for whatever reason, you can go to this big store, and it's the only one that does this. You can take cash money, and you can put it on a credit card, a load-as-you-go credit card. So, in other words, they gotcha because you're there at their store with money that you're loading on a card, and some bills you can't even pay with in cash. You have to use a card now.
Yeah.
So if you're poor, you still have to have a card. So, and I experienced this in my past 5 months of unemployment, so I know this to be true. And so you have the card, and you can make your purchases. Of course, where are you going to go? If you're getting a ride to the store, where are you going to go to do your shopping? You're already at the store. So they got you for the card, and they got you for your purchases too. So, you know, it's a form of enslavement. It's like, here, you're unemployed, so you're homeless or whatever the case may be. You are going to do business with us. We are going to get the last $5 no matter what.
Yeah, it's a company store, and if you're lucky, we'll hire you.
Yeah, and then when we do hire the women, of course, we're not going to treat you equally. So that's pretty much I'm sure everybody listening knows exactly what we're talking about, but they got you. They got you if you're poor. They got you. They got you. They got your money. They got everything. So, and it's by design. It's definitely by design.
Certainly.
So,
it's a very interesting design.
Yeah, I talked to you a little bit earlier about what's happening in this county with a lot of the homeless that are here in this county that are actually camping out. So another friend of mine who's pretty active in the community has started a charity, and she's pretty sure that most of the mothers that are involved in these camp out, they're like, what did they used to call them? Hoovervilles back in the day. Back in the Depression era, they called them Hoovervilles. But these people are living out in the woods, and they're afraid that DCS is going to step in and take their kids. So everything that they're doing in regards to being out in the woods is kept on the down low so the families can stay together. So I'm sure this is happening other places. Can you address that and tell us any other information that you have about that?
Camping is the new American survival sport. And a lot of places, first of all, a lot of places don't have shelters at all. So, you know, in the rural parts of the country that I've been driving through the past 6.5 years now, there's a lot of this country that has nothing to offer a family or homeless youth or homeless adult, you know, for shelter and barely for services, if anything. The places that do have shelter, a lot of them, most of them, I'd probably guess all of them, but that would be a guess, they are at capacity all the time. And they usually operate on a first-come, first-served basis. For any open bed space, you have to be there. So you have to go every day. And, of course, transportation is expensive and almost impossible for some people. So I've seen a place where they actually camp across from where the shelter is so that they can walk over and take advantage of things like the soup kitchen and other services, but also be there to check in to see if they can, you know, can get an indoor space. But they're camping in the woods. And, you know, certainly the big fear is Children and Family Services coming and taking the kids away, and that just becomes its own nightmare too. And it's just a really ugly scene. The other thing that's happening, and CBS on 60 Minutes a few months ago ran a big, a very powerful piece of families that are sleeping in cars and other vehicles. And any place that the weather will somewhat allow that to happen, you'll see, if you pay attention, you'll see, you know, families that are huddled in their little cars and in parking lots and wherever, and it's just a terrible way to live in this country.
When we were talking before the show, we had discussed a little bit about Jonathan's Heart, which is profiled on your website. You have some information about this story. Can you tell us a little bit about this family and what has happened to them? Do you have an update on them?
Yes, I do. Jonathan's Heart is named after Jonathan. What a surprise. And it's the story, a true story of a little, an eighth grader that I met in DeKalb, Illinois. And my friend runs a shelter there, and she was telling me the story. And it just was one of these stories where the mother and I think Jonathan, and I'm going to say I think he has one other brother, but they were staying at the shelter, and the mother was working. They were trying to get out. Everything, you know, was sort of going on track, and Jonathan kept getting sick, and, you know, he would end up, because they didn't have insurance, and they'd, you know, go to the emergency room, and, you know, it was like, poo-poo, you're not really sick, you know, take this and, you know, go back and go to school and this and that, and so he was just getting worse and worse, and, you know, the short story is that he ended up, they finally discovered right before his heart exploded, that he had a serious heart condition, and they needed to do surgery. And, you know, it was one of those things that, you know, he almost died. His mother lost her job so that she could be there to take care of him. And they ended up, you know, I mean, finally, he got better. I mean, it was just an amazing thing that when I saw him after the surgery, you would never know anything was wrong. And interesting enough that I found that he's quite the star football player at the high school. And, you know, I just can't imagine somebody going through what he did, almost dying, you know, having heart surgery, and now he's a star player at his high school. So I met him. We had a disc golf event where I took the kids from the shelter, and I had some friends, board members and all, and we played disc golf with the kids, showed them how to play, and you know, he was there, and he was just such a sweetheart, and I think he still is, from what I understand.
What are some of the obstacles in regards to nutrition for young people? Because we already know, I mean, science tells us and health tells us that if you don't have that good basic nutrition from the mother's milk, from formula, from good, you know, whole foods, you're really heading towards, you know, real bad medical problems as you get older. What are some of the obstacles and the drawbacks to being homeless and a child and having access to good food?
Well, I will certainly tell you, and I don't mean this as any offense to any of the, I'd say probably millions of volunteers that help provide food at shelters, but for any of the families that are staying in shelters, yes, there's probably some good meals that and nutritious food choices that they can make. But unfortunately, you know, like our shelter in Aurora, you know, we had upwards of 120 people a night there, and it was all volunteers supplied. So, you know, the volunteers, you know, probably would have liked to have cooked a nice, nutritious meal, but logistics made, you know, easy and bulk kind of the choice. And so food in shelters tends to not be the healthiest, and certainly it's not really geared for, you know, small children and babies. And so the parents might be real dependent on donations of, you know, appropriate formula and baby food. And I can just tell you that You know, we're always scrambling to find, you know, right-sized diapers or, you know, that type of thing. So that, I'm sure, is probably the case in most places. So nutrition is horrible, and that's in a shelter where, you know, you have at least the theory of somebody looking out for these little nomads. And then you start looking at the motels, and the families living in motels tend to be living in these 10 by 12 size rooms, no cooking facilities at all. They're lucky if they have even just the tiniest refrigerator. Usually the refrigerator ends up being ice in the bathtub. And, you know, cooking is kind of whatever can be cooked that got donated from the food pantry, if the food pantry will even serve you, because they think people staying in motels are, you know, travelers, and they don't want to be giving food to the transients. They want the food to go to the people from the community. So that gets to be another whole nightmare. But so food and food safety just kind of goes out the window, and certainly healthy food choices doesn't happen. And you know, the same when you're doubled up with somebody, living with somebody else. Trying not to cause any problems where they're going to kick you out. So you know, you might bring the food in, and, you know, if you got food, you know, food stamps, the SNAP card, and, you know, you bring food in, and, you know, your host family might be eating your food, and, you know, so it just ends up getting to be, you know, a nightmare there to try to keep food and, you know, cook it, and, you know, the host family's not eating healthy food, and it would be kind of strange for you to whip out your, you know, good healthy food. So, I mean, again, every aspect of life, the quality of life that we all are supposed to strive for, when you're in a homeless situation, it just goes out the window. It's survival.
Right. Right. As you were talking about hotels, I know here, a lot of homeless do stay in hotels, especially down towards Pinellas County and Tampa, which is south of here. And, of course, we have a lot of homeless people in this area because we have good, you know, primarily good weather. We have maybe at the most 10 or 20 really, really cold nights. The rest of the time it's temperate or just really hot. I would say that that's probably why there are a lot of homeless people here in the South, especially mm-hmm. Florida. But we were talking about hotels and the homeless staying in hotels. What about the safety factor for a lot of these homeless people? Because I know for a fact that in the hotels, especially the transient hotels, that there's a lot of drug dealing going on. So how does the family keep their children safe? And you know, there's child traffickers. Florida is one of the biggest states for child trafficking in the nation. How do you keep your children safe? There's got to be some real hard drawbacks to that, because I wouldn't even want to leave my children alone for a second if it was me. So
it is a huge problem to try to keep your kids safe in these motels. You know, I've been in a few motels that were halfway decent, but still you just know that the, you know, prostitution, drug dealing, child trafficking, all of that goes on under the nose of the motel managers. I mean, I don't know. I mean, even the higher end motels have that stuff going on. So you can't keep your children safe. And, you know, the problem in that little tiny room is, you know, nobody has privacy. It's just you are all clumped together. And going out and playing, it's usually the parking lot. And, you know, if you're in the parking lot, then you get to see the stuff. I mean, I've heard all kinds of kids talking about what they've seen in parking lots. They're getting an education that they shouldn't get in the parking lots in these hotels, not to mention the noises that you hear from surrounding rooms and the violence that goes on just as a regular feature. So, you know, for anybody to think that families staying in motels is anything less than a horrible choice, they're so sadly mistaken. And this is a battle that we've been doing, a small group of, actually a growing group of people from across the country have been fighting to get HUD to change the Department of Housing and Urban Development to change the definition that they use to define homelessness, because they say that if you're in a motel, you're not homeless. You know, that you have a place to stay. And you know, we've been pushing, and we got a little change in the definition, and now they have an absolute red tape nightmare for shelters as well as the families that are in the hotels trying to get into the shelter. But they, you know, because HUD is maintaining, and they say this, it's, you know, it's not as bad as being, you know, homeless in other situations. So they consider people that are staying with somebody else or people that are in motels not homeless, not really homeless. And they don't count them, they don't report them, even though it is the bulk of the homeless population are staying in the motels or living with other people. It's a number that has not begun to hit members of Congress in the face. And we want to change that.
What has to be done to change the definition? What kind is it? Legislation or I don't know.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Well, actually, we are moving along in that process, and I know this is going to sound strange to you and some of the listeners, but we have a true champion for homeless kids in Congress. She happens to be my Congresswoman, Judy Biggert. She's a Republican woman from the suburban area in Chicago, outside of Chicago. And she, for the past, 14 years since she's been in Congress, she actually toured our shelter her first year. And she made the mistake of asking me, she had that sort of deer in the headlight look to her after she finished. And she's like, well, what do you want me to do? And at that point, I just blurted out, I want you to get our Illinois homeless education law passed on the federal level. So that's the history. She actually managed to do that and has also worked on legislation to improve things for, you know, the kids that are without a parent to sign their FAFSA form, and a few other things. So she's got a bill, H.R. 32, and you can actually read about it if you're curious. The we have a website designed for our little campaign, and it's helphomelesskidsnow.org, helphomelesskidsnow.org. And you can go there, and you can actually sign to get your member of Congress. It's a real easy process to get your member of Congress to ask her or him to go and be a co-sponsor. It's bipartisan legislation. It will just tweak the policies that HUD uses, and it will bring their definition in line with other federal departments that have a more enlightened definition. So it's a process that's been going on now for, I testified for this particular cause back in 2007. So we've been fighting that hard. There is legislation that has passed, and it's a, you know, we have a chance to, you know, we have a chance to get it to happen. So we need some grassroots pressure.
So the main thing to know is that these bills or anything having to do with the homeless doesn't have any consistent verbiage. Everything is cataloged, categorized differently, and how they've written these things up is all different. So this would make it all standard, a standard definition. Is that
standard? Yeah, you've got it. A standard, streamlined definition that will allow local communities to decide what their priorities are, and if the you know, the population that they've been literally ignoring for, well, the 25 years or so that the McKinney-Vento Act has been in place, they've ignored families and they've ignored the youth that are on their own. So this
now,
this
what is that
is,
site again to sign? To sign the
okay,
one
it's
for
helphomelesskidsnow.org.
Helphomelesskidsnow.org. Helphomelesskidsnow.org. I will put that on the blog post.
Great.
You know where I'll put the archive of the show so people can find that. But yeah, that sounds like something that's pretty easy to do no matter where you are, is just go there, sign it, and then call your congressperson, representative, and say, okay, you got to get behind this.
Right. And, you know, Anita, the sad thing is over the years that I've been doing this, people just don't really, for the most part, prioritize the issue of homeless kids. Congress is clueless, except for a few people. And they just don't understand that it's kids. They will be shocked. You're a member of Congress. If you get to talk to them or a staffer, they will absolutely just be befuddled by the fact that you're talking about homeless kids.
Yeah. Or even showing them, you know, the movie.
Yeah.
You know, the movie that you already have done, My Own Four Walls. Shoot, it wouldn't be a bad idea to actually send them a copy. Here, watch
well,
this. It won't take you long to watch it, but please come on board with this legislation and let's get it all standardized and consistent so it means the same across the board.
Yeah, and you know, as much as I'd love to sell as many DVDs as possible because that's how I keep from being homeless wherever I am, it is also something that you can watch a four-minute trailer right on our website. And, you know, you could send that link right to your member of Congress, a staff person that handles the issue of homelessness. And in 4 minutes, they can hear from kids. And,
right.
It's just a really easy way. But also on the helphomelesskidsnow.org website, I've made a couple, and I'm going to be making some more, short two-minute videos. So there's a link there that says videos, and you can look at two stories that of women that I've talked to very recently and, put together a little film on that. So,
well,
information.
I will definitely be passing that link around. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit about how, when you started traveling and when you became an RVer and how you had to, that had to be challenging. I mean, my other half and I, we've sat here and talked about, you know, not renting anymore and getting an RV and how inexpensive it would be. And then, you know, we think about, oh, but we have all this space in this house. So it has to be an extremely challenging thing to be able to be a nomad yourself and scale down to just have just the basic necessities, whatever you can fit in an RV and go traveling in. So how in the world did you ever do that?
Oh, if you could be a fly on the wall, you would be a laughing fly. It was really kind of a hysterical process. I had learned in the end of March 2005 that my project that I was directing, which was to help the 305 school districts in the Chicagoland area understand and implement the McKinney-Vento Homeless Education Act. So I was doing that. I have a small staff. We were doing an awesome job. However, there were a few little flies in the ointment, and we had a few superintendents that weren't really fond of the idea of educating homeless students, even though the law said to the contrary. And so for some reason, and I'm just speculating, but I think perhaps I stepped on a few toes in the school world, and they ended my project just as a colleague, Barbara Duffield, and I were working on, we had gotten a grant and we had hired a film production company and they were going to come out the following week and start filming kids talking about what it's like to be homeless, with the idea that, you know, you can't parade kids into a teacher training professional development session, but you could have a film, and the kids talking would really be effective. So anyhow, so I get told my project's ending, we're not going to be able to do the film, and in 3 months I was going to be out of a job again. And I was just kind of going like, oh, no. And I sat around. Actually, I was watching the video Winged Migration, and I was, you know, just kind of woe is me. Now what am I going to do with my life? And, you know, I had my dream job at the shelter, and that ended somewhat prematurely, but that was a good thing, actually. And this was a dream job, and now what am I going to do? And I just thought this film was so vitally important for just all kinds of audiences, and I really wanted the kids to have voice and visibility. And I just thought, well, Diane, if you want it that much, if it's that important, then do it. And I just thought, well, how am I going to do that? So I, you know, I owned at the time a nice little 1,100 square foot townhouse in a very nice area, and I was just totally happy with that. And I thought, well, you know, this has got to go. And I started, you know, when I was watching Winged Migration, I was thinking, gosh, I haven't traveled since I was in college. And I was looking at the part in the Grand Canyon. I was just kind of going like, well, can I get a job that where I do what I really love doing and advocating for homeless kids and travel? And then I'm like, how can I make that movie? And so all the pieces just sort of came together in a very bizarre sort of way. And I just thought about... I need to get to the back roads. I need to go to the places in the country where people don't think there's homelessness, because then it, when it defies logic, it gets your attention a little bit more. I mean, I could have just gone right into Chicago from where I lived, and, you know, that would have saved a lot of trouble, but it wouldn't have made the point. So I just started thinking about the RV, and I'm as a tent camper. I mean, I'm out in a rugged woods tent camper. And I used to hate RVs. And I guess the moral of the story is never hate something that much, because you end up doing it. So I sold my townhouse before the real estate bubble exploded, and bought this little 27-foot motorhome. We had a big garage sale, and I just whittled down my stuff to what I thought I really couldn't get rid of. And it's I'm traveling with it now. Have whittled down some more, and I've been on the road ever since. I live in this full time, and I go everywhere. I've got 140,000 miles on it, and I've been in 48 states. So,
wow,
it's been a strange thing, because I travel alone except when I pick up strays like Pat LaMarche, and you know, travel with her for a couple weeks, but. You know, it's just been something totally beyond my wildest dreams. And, you know, I've seen parts of the country that people don't even know are out there. I love the back roads. And it also has put me in contact with people that I never would have met had I not taken this crazy plunge. So I'm not the textbook RVer by any means. I'm self-taught, and it gets ugly sometimes, but I'm doing it.
So it was kind of like a learn-as-you-go process, and then in the process of that, you also had to lose an attachment to things and places and all of that. That had to be difficult.
Well, you know, it was, and you know, I have some really, really treasured friends in the Chicagoland area, and you know, although I didn't see, you know, like some of my friends, I knew they were there. But my work, you know, whether it was at the shelter or in the job with the schools, you know, I just didn't have a lot of free time anyhow. So, you know, the phone or email works fine. And then, of course, Facebook comes out, and that just opens it up more. But, you know, so it's just one of those things where I had to shift my life at the age of 55. You know, I shifted my life in a seismic way. I mean, it was just absolutely unimaginable. I never would have predicted it, and yet I've gotten so much out of it that I just really am very grateful that I did it.
What do you not like about traveling?
The gas prices. But, no, you know, other than that, and we won a Citgo $5,000 gas card, so that really has helped in the states where the Citgo gas stations are operating. You know, I have to say I can't really think of anything that I don't like. There's sometimes when it might be inconvenient or I might not have water in my tank or, you know, those kind of things. But, you know, it's all minor inconveniences compared to, you know, being able to do this job. Sometimes I'm freezing because I don't have electricity and I'm sitting in here trying to work and my battery's going dead and that kind of stuff. But that's all minor stuff. You know, I have to say that I feel so empowered where I can go where I think I need to go and follow a story that I want to chronicle and, you know, try to dig out a story or meet people or you know, stay in somebody's backyard plugged into their house that I never knew before. So it's been an adventure in ways that I never would have been able to predict.
And I did want to mention, for those of you that are listening that want to contribute, you know, Diane needs gas and travel expenses as she does this job. It's an amazing job, and it's a job that was just created for you and just kind of landed in your lap. That's amazing. And that happened by divine intervention. I can't think of any other
way. Yeah, It really was something far beyond what I could explain as any kind of logic and good thinking. And let me just thank you for the plug on the donations. And just to be clear, the motor home I bought with my own money, and it's my expenses, my personal expense to operate it. The gas here us buys, unless I'm on a trip where I'm doing a totally personal thing, but it's Hear Us is my nonprofit organization, and we've made it really easy for people to donate. If you go to the hearus.us website, there's a thing there that says donate. And if you have any trouble at all, just let me know, and I'll help you out.
The on the blue taskbar, if you go to the right of the blue taskbar, right on the front page of the website, hearus.us, there's a little red circle with a hand. And right next to that, you just click on that, and it'll take you right to the donation page.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at it right now. But it's a beautiful, beautifully done, streamlined website. I did want to ask you, how do you think Facebook has helped you? I mean, I know Facebook came onto the scene, and there were a lot of us older people that were still trying to navigate through MySpace and a lot of other social networks, then all of a sudden everybody was like, get on Facebook, and everybody migrated there. And I think at that point it was just kind of like a communication explosion. How did it help what you're doing now?
Well, you know, I went kicking and screaming into Facebook. You know, I thought it was too much of a fad to really be worthwhile, but then I realized that it wasn't. You know, one of my colleagues, I was at the time blogging for change.org, and she's like, you have to be on Facebook for Hear Us. And I'm like, yeah. So, you know, it was, I've been on since 2007, and I have to say I hated it at first. But now I'm pretty excited about it. You know, I'm pretty open on there, and I friend as many people as I can. And, you know, I try to make it interesting. I try to post a few times a day, and people really are interacting. And the neatest thing for me is it's connected me with people from my past, people that I taught in school back in the 70s, or people that I had, you know, that were staying in our shelter or volunteering, or, you know, all kinds of people. Plus, you know, the networking that goes on, it's been tremendous. And you know, yeah, I could say a lot of bad things about Facebook, and I'm not trying to kiss up to Mark Zuckerberg at all, but You know, it for me has been a way of keeping in contact with my national network, or actually international in some cases. So it's been a weird thing, and it's also been a good way for me to sort of keep up on stories about homelessness and generate a lot more interest in the issue than if I were not there. I'm not on it. I mean, I do a few little fun things, but mostly my posts are related to homeless families and homeless youth and homeless adults on occasion when I can't resist sharing some horrible stories that happen, and or good stories in some cases. But it's been a really good thing for me. And now I'm on Pinterest or whatever this crazy thing is. I'm going, oh no, here I go again. But I think that'll be good too.
Now, for those of you that want to join Diane on Facebook, she's at Diane Neelan, N-I-L-A-N, Hear Us, Hear-Us. So, and you'll see a little, it looks like a little drawing of you. Who did the drawing? Because that's you in the minivan.
It is me. it's actually my good friend Pat Van Doren, is an author of children's books. She was a photojournalist before she retired a few years ago, but she wrote some children's books. They're amazingly wonderful children's book, very realistic about homeless kids. You can all find those on our website too. And the artist for her books, Wanda Platt, worked with Pat at the newspaper, and Wanda is an absolute tremendous artist. She did this great job in Pat's books. And I'm in Pat's first book, the Volcano book, I'm the centerfold. La, la, la. Jealous, are you? and then in the sequel to that book, which is A Place of Our Own, they did that portrayal of me, or Wanda did that of me in the book. So it's in there, and it's kind of a cute little picture of me in, you know, in Tilly, my motorhome. So, yeah.
And for those of you that don't know, Diane is also on Pinterest, which is I would think that this is a new social network. I just heard about it probably last week and signed in, but I haven't really got it yet. I don't understand it, and I don't think I've posted anything there yet. I just like created a profile.
Yeah, it's there'll be a little learning curve there, and I'm just on it for a few days and kind of going, getting it, but it's taken a while. So, but again, it's I'm always happy just to interact with folks from wherever.
And the other one that I just found recently was called Trap It.
Well, I don't want to know about another one. Shut up.
Because Facebook was really exploding when I was working with staff at the Kucinich campaign in 2008, the presidential campaign. It was pretty funny because we had to have volunteers that were all the college students that were doing the Facebook, because I just wasn't getting it and I wasn't understanding, even though I had been the one to put together Dennis's MySpace page. So I had done that first, and then all of a sudden Facebook was very quickly speeding past MySpace, getting more and more users. So, I was like where you were at. I was dragged kicking and screaming into it, not fully really understanding how it worked and why, what the purpose. I thought, well, if everybody has a MySpace page, what is the purpose of Facebook? I don't know.
Yeah, right. You start shaking your head at this stuff. But, you know, I do think Facebook is it. But, you know, the other thing is I have to just share the story about you know, our means of communication. Email certainly is still there. And I got an email last week from a woman who she and her daughter are homeless in DuPage County. And this woman had obviously done some research. She actually read my book, which makes me indebted to her for doing that. And she... you know, was just asking for suggestions. She didn't want money. I'm sure she'd be happy for it, but she wasn't asking for money. She was just wondering if I had any suggestions as somebody, you know, being from that area on how she could get, she and her daughter are staying in one of these rotating shelters where they're in a different, you know, safe communities building every night. And it's a grueling way to go. Her daughter's 14. She's out there, and, you know, the mom is working, and it's just it is just an impossible way to live by yourself, much less with a child to take care of. And so, you know, she emailed me her story, and you know, I'm certainly streetwise enough to know that people can tell you stories, but I, you know, I asked her some questions, and we've been exchanging information. And I have to say, Anita, it's just, you know, we're talking about one of the richest counties in the country. DuPage County is one of the richest counties in the country. And here's a woman and her daughter. She gets up at 3 or so in the morning, gets her daughter ready. They leave the shelter. She has to walk. She's working at McDonald's. They both walk to McDonald's. The school bus comes to McDonald's to pick up the girl to take her to school and then brings her back. And then they have to, like, hang out when mom's done working. They hang out in libraries and other places until the shelter opens at night. And, you know, this is a life that hundreds of thousands of people are going through tonight as we sit here and have this conversation, where they're just, you know, night by night surviving, you know, on the goodness of people who are willing to come out and volunteer and support these, you know, nighttime emergency shelters. Emergency means, like, emergency, we're going to get over that soon, and we haven't. But, it, you know, she says, I'm just looking at her email now. We have a frightening life. Among us are criminals, but yet some of the most gentle people you'll ever meet. In the shelter, and I won't even name the shelter, but they cannot really do anything for us because, that, you know, there's people that are just, you know, calling back countless calls, and that's it. And there's so many people looking for help and so little help out there. And this is, you know, this isn't a place, this is not a slum, it's not a ghetto, it's a very affluent community.
And I think just to think about the things that can actually spiral downward happening to a family or even to just a single person, how you can become homeless in such a short time if you're not part of that. I hate to make that reference, but it's true. If you're not part of the 1%, you can end up having a slew of different things happening to you, and you can end up homeless in a month, 2 months, a week, 3 days.
Oh, sure. It happens in a blink of an eye. And it, you know, even people who think they're immune. I mean, I've watched a woman ironing her silk nightgown at our shelter. She was from a very affluent community, St. Charles in Illinois. She had been married to somebody, had lived a very affluent life. And divorce and just hard times hit. And here she was standing there ironing her nightgown at our shelter ironing board. And
Diane, we have a caller. And it's from area code 207. Caller, what's your name?
Hi, I'm Jan Lightfoot.
Hi, Jan. And did you have a question for Diane?
Hello there, Jan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
What I'm wanted to say is hello to you. It's the first time I've actually spoken to you. And what do you think is the reason, the number one cause of homelessness?
Well, Jan, you and I know that certainly of the many, many causes of homelessness, I think the one thing, if we fixed it tonight, that would have probably the greatest impact would be if we paid people a decent wage for their work. What do you think?
Okay, great.
You like that idea?
That is a great idea.
Okay, we'll put that into practice here. When I'm elected president, yeah, okay.
Run.
Yeah.
I'll vote for you. Okay, one of the things I want to say that's happening in the poverty field is that there is going to be a march June 30th in Washington, D.C., and now is the time for people to go to their churches, to go to their organization, and start to get buses or whatever to get there on June 30th.
Okay.
And anybody, huh?
June 30th, oh, okay.
June 30th, it's a Saturday. Anybody who wants more information can look up on oneclassonecause.org.
Okay, and I think you popped that on my website or on my Facebook page there.
Yep.
So that's good. Okay. All right, great. I'm glad you called, and I'm glad you put that on my Hear Us Facebook page. So we'll share that around and you know, spread the word.
Wonderful.
We hope to
have as many people there as they did for the Civil Rights March back in 1964.
Let me ask you, Jan, what's the name of that march again?
The march, I don't know if it has a name, but the group, one of the groups putting it on is One Class, One Pure, no, One Class,
One
Cause.
One Class, One Cause.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, very, very good.
Great.
All right.
Thanks for sharing that.
Link.
And you're doing great. Just keep it up.
Thank you very
much.
You. That's high praise from you.
Take care.
Thank you for calling.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Great. Thanks.
I definitely want to get some more information about that march. It sounds interesting. Let me ask you this, Diane. What is your take on the Occupy movement, and how has that helped bring homelessness to the front and forefront of basically the struggles going on here in the United States?
You know, I'll tell you what, Anita, it was very heartening to see what turned into a wildfire, but a substantive effort of advocacy, systemic grassroots advocacy on the issues of poverty and all the things that go with it. And I think, you know, we could criticize this, that, or the other thing about the movement, but gosh, they sure got us talking about poverty and the, you know, the 99% and the 1%. You just, you know, people who didn't know these things, now there's a growing number of people who are just kind of shaking their heads going, wait a minute, you mean I don't have to just put up with this, that we can do something about it? So I think certainly it was a movement, you know, that its time was right. It's not too late, but I think they came around just in time. And I'm looking forward to the follow-up that will be a natural occurrence, because I think a lot of people have awakened and they're pissed. I mean, that's just...
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
and
yeah.
I found that this is, they're pissed, and it's righteous anger. It's, you know, why can't I get my way, you know, get my way through college? Why is college costing me too much? Why is our food supply poisoned? You know, the question...
Why are the banks getting the houses and the houses are sitting empty and I'm sitting on the curb? I mean, it's... You know, it's just
right.
We're not nitpicking here. We're looking at out and out injustice, and saying, you know what? No, that's not really okay anymore. It's like, you know, people being in an abusive relationship when all of a sudden somebody wakes up and says, I don't have to take this anymore. And I think enough people are getting to that point where those who are in that 1% power track, I think they're getting a little unnerved, and you know, they unleash the likes of blubbermouth rushbo on, you know, on just on anybody. It's just it's turning into an attack mode, and it's just, you know, but there's a lot more of us out there than they think, and we can't be silent.
I've heard our, you know, our take on things, and I'm speaking very generally for most Americans, that I've heard us compared to the abused wife, the abused codependent wife, you know, going to our leaders and asking for, you know, can I have some more, please, you know, like that.
Yeah.
And
if it's not too much trouble.
Now it has to be demands. And, you know, right now, for instance, this week, the biggest injustice happening, one of the biggest injustices happening in the country is there's sick and dying people in the Gulf region now. And BP is going to walk away. Why? You know, the legal situation, they moved the trial, and now they're working out some kind of deal. And this is really just, it's blowing the people's minds that live in the Gulf region that this has even occurred, because not a single health claim has been paid out. So from BP, they have not paid anybody that is sick. So this has become systemic through every single issue, homelessness being at the very top, along with living wage, affordable housing, all of that is tied in together. We did have another caller, and they dropped. I don't know why. Caller, if you want to ask a question, please call us back. I couldn't click you quick enough, so please call back if you can. But this is the big thing, is how all of this is tied together. And I support, of course, Move to Amend, which is to add the 8th Amendment to the Constitution to abolish corporate personhood. That caller is back on from area code 630. So I'm going to click them in now.
All right.
Hello, caller. Can you tell us your name and where you're calling from?
My name is Karen Turk, and I'm calling from the suburbs of Chicago.
And did you have a question for Diane tonight?
Well, I've had the pleasure and great fun to work with Diane, and I've been listening to listening to this show and thinking how wonderful it is, Anita, that you've given such a wonderful format. And I think as I've listened to this and heard the caller earlier talking about the march in Washington, I think of myself, my whole life has been involved with issues of child abuse and neglect and the whole issue of children. And I think we're all looking for a way, including everything that our country needs to get mobilized about, is to be very serious about our young, you know, our tiniest citizens, and to really take seriously that we as a nation do so poorly on a global scale, and really help people see that somehow we have just let the fabric of a safety net unravel, and try to bring that discussion back alive to say we have the resources. I think we've been so stymied by so many roadblocks about real discussion, and like when Diane is creating, you know, the little snow beds, I think people just don't understand that this plight affects our most vulnerable and tiniest little people. And I guess I just have great hope that through whatever we do, that we can bring that into a national discussion where people at all levels are saying, this is not acceptable. We will not allow this to continue. That tiny children do not have a safe place to live. Focusing on that group.
Yeah, Ms. Turk, it's so good to hear from you. I will just remind everybody, and I need to remind myself, any social change that we did manage to accomplish, and we'll just talk this country, none of it happened without a fight. It wasn't like our lawmakers woke up one day and said, well, we're all in a collective good mood. Let's see, what's the need in our country? Let's take care of those little children, make sure they have everything they need. I mean, I wish that would happen, but it never has, except for, you know, self-interest kind of causes. But So we have to be that voice, and all of us, in whatever way we can, we need to, whether it's, you know, going on the website and, you know, to our helphomelesskidsnow.org website or the Hear Us website, and, you know, getting involved in at least rattling a cage of a lawmaker, or volunteering, or helping, you know, on a one-on-one basis, helping a family that's beleaguered by poverty and homelessness or whatever. And it's, we all can do something. So it's, you know, I think it's just a good reminder that we need to, you know, push for change and not take no for an answer.
I
think when you have a format like this, however many people hear it, it, I think just the connection factor. Diane mentioned earlier when the caller asked what's the main cause of homelessness, and, you know, decent wages, obviously. But I think another thing that a lot of people are not aware of, coupled with that, is just a lack of affordable housing. And here we're not talking even about the poorest. We're just talking about everyday people that no longer can afford. You know, we have gone through a time in our country where all the money went into building luxury, you know, high-end living situations, and very little investment in what you would call decent, affordable housing. You know, in our area, I watched that happen during my career working with poor single moms, that during the 30 years I was working in our community, the amount of any kind of low-cost housing just dried up, you know, with just that little tiny piece of, you know, publicly supported housing. So I think that's another thing that a lot of people don't really realize as a day-to-day thing, that we are a country that doesn't afford, you know, has done nothing to help create decent, affordable housing. You know, we've gone the other way with communities through their planning boards and whatever, with their eyes on, you know, the high-end place. And I don't think people notice that impact, that if you keep putting your community resources into building luxury and high-end, what is happening to your everyday people. And I remember there was an interesting thing here in Chicago. They were talking, there was one community that wanted to put money aside to build housing for police officers and teachers, and they got voted down. I mean, we're talking about in their community, they didn't feel like teachers and police officers could afford decent housing. And I thought, that just caught my imagination, because I thought, no wonder we're in trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
And we can talk about just me being a licensed healthcare person, can't find a job, and, you know, I'm living in a house that's way over any kind of price. The only reason I can live here is because I get a widow's pension, because I was widowed at a very young age in the military. And my rent is $1,000. And when I lived in Tampa, I live in the country now, but when I lived in Tampa, I paid $900 for an apartment that was probably one-third the square footage of this house. So $900 for somebody that's not making very much money, that's a lot of money. So just recently, as I went through this unemployment, this little bout of unemployment, a couple of friends said, oh, well, you need to move. Just go ahead and move into a mobile home. And I said, you know, this is kind of spent, because they don't realize, because they haven't moved in a while, that it costs probably $5,000 to $6,000 to move across town.
Yeah, it's definitely.
And people don't get that. You're paying first and last month's rent, then you're paying rent, then you're paying an electric deposit. In Florida, if you don't have your electric on, you can be evicted immediately. That's the law.
Nice.
Florida statute 83. So when you're turning all this stuff on and off, and then you're paying all these fees, and then you're getting a truck to move you, that's about the...
Absolutely.
It really doesn't matter if you're moving from one town to the other here in Florida, 40 miles apart, or if I'm packing that truck and moving to Atlanta. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So
no,
I'm paying the
and
money.
Interesting, Anita, you're talking as a person who we would see in general. you would be part of a group that was usually seen as stable and not facing decisions like that. And I think that's
helpful. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I wish I was a nurse, but I'm a CNA, and so I don't even make a third of what a nurse makes. It would be nice, but, you know, as a CNA, too, I can provide health care, but I can't get any. Isn't that rich?
No, now there's another whole can of worms you opened. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
So,
yeah.
You know, so this is what's going on with, you know, and we're not just talking, I mean, homeless is a big issue, and it's a huge issue, and having work and having a livable wage and having affordable housing, this is why I said this is all tied in together. So people can be made homeless just by being underemployed.
Certainly.
You know?
And anybody that thinks they are immune from homelessness is wrong. I'm sorry. I don't even care how much money you have. You know, maybe the ultra-millionaire billionaires might have a little bit of security, but I'll tell you what, it's something that can happen, and any number of reasons can cause it. And once you get in it, it's a lot harder to get out of it.
Do you ever see
Anita,
your homeless?
Sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, Anita, I was just saying, your comments about what you personally went through made me think a few years back I heard at a networking meeting where social service types were talking, and that was in a wealthy community. And she pointed out that the people there, none of them could have then afforded to buy their houses. The only reason they could afford to live in that community and were, you know, was that they had bought their, you know, their ages. They had bought their houses like 20 years before him when they were first starting out, that they would not be able to now afford to buy a home in their community. And that it was one of the reasons why a lot of people, you know, were not able to work in the community. So I think it's just like a very complex fabric of how people are affected, and that anyone that faces any kind of a life crisis, whether that be loss of a job, a health problem, a divorce, if you, you know, a child's illness, I think any of those things can just topple somebody over the canyon. And I don't think that used to be as true as it is presently, that people that have been in a stable situation can so quickly topple into losing things. Diane, would you answer that?
Oh, I
think that's very true. And you know, I have never been able to qualify for a home. I'm in my 50s, and I've never been able to own a home. And I'm a veteran, so that's kind of amazing that I'm in this situation now. But I was just going to ask Diane, how often do you think catastrophic illness within a family can actually propel a family into homelessness?
Oh, Anita, I think, you know, a catastrophic illness by its very nature is something that pushes people towards homelessness, depending on whatever kind of cushion they might have in resources financially. But you know, when it's catastrophic, they don't use that word lightly, and it really, I've talked to a lot of people over the years that their health issue and the financial part of it and dealing with it, if they've recovered, that's a fast track to homelessness.
Okay.
And it's domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
Dan, I just heard that research repeated on public radio the other day, that the leading cause of why people lose their homes is a health crisis.
Certainly.
That's what pushes people to
it
loss
doesn't even
their
have
home.
To be a big. It doesn't have
no.
to be a big crisis. I mean, you know, I broke my ankle 20 years ago. I had insurance, you know, and it was a $14,000, you know, surgery and whatever, you know, and I had to pay my little 20% of it, you know, which took me a while. But that was then, and now it's so much worse that, you know, a trip to the emergency room can put you in the poorhouse.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
And usually, you know, I think any kind of it doesn't have to be catastrophic, just any kind of serious illness or injury can lead to loss of employment. and everything just spirals down, or loss of income for some extended period of time. Well, I'm going to drop off. This has been really fun, but I want to let you, I will drop off the call so that you two can talk to each other because I don't want to be interfering here. Thank you so much, Anita. What a wonderful program.
Thank you for calling in. I appreciate that.
Oh, this is wonderful. Now I have you bookmarked. I will now become, Diane is much more technologically smart than I am. She is always helping my learning curve. So this is now on my bookmark to follow your program. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Well, we'll go back to some more questions. I did want to let people know that there is an order form on hearus.us. If you would like to order the DVDs, we have a DVD, On the Edge. Can you tell us a little bit about On the Edge?
Yeah, I was certainly wanting to make sure we spent some time talking about On the Edge because it's a very important film for understanding the realities of homelessness as seen by women. When I first finished my first round of travels back in 2006, and I met for the first time Dr. Laura Vasquez at Northern Illinois University, and a mutual friend connected us, and she saw the video, some of the clips that I shot on my interviews of the kids, and she agreed to help me, you know, by producing the film that I wanted. And then she had, at the very first meeting, she had a question for me. She said, what would you think about doing a feature-length film about homeless women? And I just looked at her and I said, because I'm like that, I know it's a surprise, but I just bluntly said, so what's in it for you? Why do you want to do this? And she shared a story, which she has shared publicly, so I'm not talking out of school here, but that when she was in her early 20s and had a young baby boy, and her husband was abusive, and she decided that she needed to get out and left Illinois, hopped in an old car and had about $100 or so to her name and drove across the country to California and started staying in people's couches from place to place as she could until she got back on her feet. And, you know, and that was a while back when it was a little easier to get back on your feet. And I'm sure it wasn't easy, but she made it. And she's now, you know, pretty prominent in the documentary world. All that is to be said that we decided to go and film interviews of women. We settled on the stories that we got of seven women. They are incredibly articulate, and their situations of homelessness they're not all the same. They represent women who have served in the military, women who have been married, women who have been, you know, drug addicts on the streets from the time they were young kids. Just the whole gamut of homelessness as as it is commonly experienced by most women. And so we interviewed them, and I followed them and did some filming in between, and we have their stories as it was back in 2008 when we did the filming, and then we've done some follow-up. And it's an hour-long documentary. It's one that has received countless awards, and we've been in film festivals, and it's just been a well-received film. I've screened it all over the country to all kinds of audiences, including in members of Congress and the HUD secretary and the Interagency Council on Homelessness director. And it's a film that has seven women telling you about what it's like to be homeless, and it needs to be seen. So we're very excited to announce, and this is something right on the Hear Us website, hearus.us, on the homepage. You just look down a little ways, and you will see that we are encouraging people to contact their PBS affiliate. And this is a film that's been approved for broadcast on PBS stations on Mother's Day. And to
oh,
me,
that'd
that
be
is just
fine.
Yeah, it's such an exciting thing because a little community activism, and we have everything you need, and it's just click, click, and just write a quick sentence or two in an email. It's all, it'll go right to your affiliate, your PBS affiliate, and it can happen. It can be seen in communities across the country on Mother's Day, and we're going to just work on a campaign to make that, to bring that about.
So everybody listening, whether you're listening now or on the archives later, go to hearus.us. When you go to the home page, you'll see a heading that says how you can help right now. And there's five hyperlinks underneath that. The first one is Get the Edge on PBS. And you just click it. And it'll take you right there to where you can.
It'll take you right to your, you don't need to look up anything. We just made it really easy. And like I said, this has been pre-approved. It's just very exciting.
Well, it'll be nice to see it on Mother's Day. So that would be an amazing event to get it on PBS on Mother's Day, because that really, in my opinion, that would be a perfect time to air that movie.
The women, as they talk, they really talk a lot about their mothers, and you know, in ways that are painful and also ways that are good. And you just kind of know that we are all connected. We all have mothers. And,
right.
And it's a viewpoint that really doesn't get taken, and we're excited to be able to share this.
So we've got the on this order form on the website, hearus.us, is the movie we just discussed, On the Edge, the other DVD, My Own Four Walls. We have the book that Diane wrote called Crossing the Line, Taking Steps to End Homelessness. Another book, It's About the Children. Another one, Where Can I Build My Volcano? Both of those, It's About the Children, is that also a children's book?
Yes, it's actually a series. There's one that lists all three of them together as a set. Which is $40, or each of the individual books, books.
Where Can I Build My Volcano, A Family of Five or Six and A Place of Our Own. Okay,
right.
And then, so I encourage everybody, if you want to donate, that's great. If you want to purchase these items, you can do it right on the website, and these would be great, great items if you're doing homeschooling. If you want to teach your children about what's really going on as well with other children, I think these would be great resources as well. So even children of a certain age and above would know what's going on in their communities, and maybe they would even want to help.
They undoubtedly will, yeah.
That's amazing. We have some great local initiatives like that where the children are putting together homeless packages, or, you know, packages for the homeless and food during the holidays. And I always love to see that being done.
Well, interesting enough, Anita, since you're from the Tampa area, one of the little children's books, Family of Five or Six, was actually illustrated by kids from the Tampa area, from Carol Wood Day School.
That's right in Tampa. Yeah. Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So they worked with Pat, the author, on the book, because I told Pat I didn't have time to give her the hurricane information that she needed. It was right after Hurricane Katrina had hit, and Pat wanted to write a book about a family that became homeless because of that. And so I said, you need some homelessness experts, and one thing led to the other, and I connected her with a class of fifth and sixth graders down there, and they took it from there. So they illustrated it.
Wow, that's an amazing thing. Now, see, they were made homeless, but also a lot of people, there's two other terms I use with things like the Gulf oil spill and Katrina and other things like that. I call that a diaspora, and I also call that climate refugees. So when you're dealing with either of those things, diaspora or climate refugees, in regards to families, they're made homeless. There's people that have moved out of the Gulf region because, you know, their children are continually getting sick from the toxic air and the toxic water. So I'm in touch and networked. And again, this is an amazing situation to see because of the connections that I've made all over the Gulf region. These were people that normally I would have never even come into contact with.
Sure,
but it's amazing how the connections have been made and everybody's helping one another to gain awareness. But I remember some of the Katrina people that came here, even to this particular county and the two counties south of here. And there was a huge outreach going on through the local churches at that time to get families, homeless families, in and get somebody to host them so they would have a place to live and so the children could enroll in schools. So there was a huge drive for that. And I'm thinking to myself, why would there be a huge drive to do that after something as cataclysmic as a hurricane and a flood? And why can't that be done? Why can't that be considered in the same ad hoc emergency type situation all the time for the homeless?
Well, you know, there's certainly a lot of very good thinking behind that thought. And really, it's just I think our nation needs a compassion epidemic.
I like that.
I sort of preach compassion epidemic because I think it is something we can totally give up on our country, but most of us can't leave it, so we have to stay here. And I think we can either let the minority, powerful as they may think they are, win and destroy our country and destroy any compassion tendencies that we might have, or we can create a compassion epidemic. And I think, you know, what you see, at least what I watched on the news, and I know some people up in the Indiana area where the tornadoes just leveled communities and killed people and injured people. And, you know, you see the good of humanity coming out and helping to pick up papers, clean up yards, you know, search for people, you know, doing all the good things that we are as human beings capable of doing. And I think we just need to be doing that more and encouraging it more and realizing that we are all in this country together to, you know, somehow we are going to need to survive. We can't watch millions and millions of people in poverty just go down the tubes. I mean, that's just not even an option.
Wow. Yeah. It's constant. It doesn't have to be precipitated by some cataclysmic climate event or weather event or whatever, or ecocide and terricide that's happened in the Gulf of Mexico. The homeless issue and homeless people are here, and they're here now, and they need help now. So, you know, I'm telling people that are listening now and later, we can't wait. These people can't wait, especially the children. They need to be going to school. They need healthy food. They need a roof over their heads. I did want to mention that I just did find the site for that march on D.C. on June 3rd. The website is end-poverty.org. And the title of the website is Assembly to End Poverty. So it's the USSF. So I'm trying to find out who that is. The People's Movement Assembly. So this is going to be a big event in D.C. on June 30th, 2012. And I would say if you can get there, get there, because I'm going to try to get.
Me too. I think, you know, it's funny. Again, I was there at the Housing Now March in 1989, and, you know, I don't remember the number, but hundreds of thousands of people gathered. And I was, you know, at a few other marches that were very significant in D.C. over the years. And there's something about that that, you know, you can say, well, what good does it do? But it really does. You know, you're taking a stand, you're making an effort, you get to know people that are believing the same as you do, and you're doing something constructive. You know, it really is constructive. And really, our country needs a lot of constructive activities, and I'm glad to hear about this. I'm glad Jan brought it to our attention, and you know, because sometimes I sort of skim over things and sort of miss it. So thank you, Jan, for doing that. And hopefully we can, you know, can get a very impressive crowd to say to our government on all levels, our state government, our local government, as well as our federal government, that, you know, people are important. They're the most important. And people in poverty are growing, and we need to address the, you know, the multiple causes of poverty, because poverty and homelessness go hand in hand, and frankly, we can't deal with any more homelessness in this country.
Well, it's pretty frightening to hear the numbers in the mainstream media of the unemployment and the underemployed, but then when you're actually talking to people on the street, it appears to be more like 25% to 30% are not working or they're underemployed. So, you know, along with the homelessness, having affordable housing, having a living wage that's actually going to be able to cover your rent or mortgage and your bills, you know, I don't like to be negative and say the American dream is gone, but yet I talk to people every single day that say they don't have the American dream and they don't expect to get it in their lifetimes. And I'd like to be part of that change, you know? So,
You know, the American dream is certainly, it's got some dark clouds hanging over it, and they are the dark clouds that, especially in the past, you know, 5 or 6 years, that have really gotten dark. But I have to just say that we can't just give. I mean, we don't have the option of giving up on the American dream, because, you know, if you look at what the alternative is, it's a horrible thing. But you mentioned numbers, and I want to kind of get on a bandwagon here. And I want to do this sort of quickly, and I'm not a real numbers person when it comes to, you know, citing how many millions of homeless people and stuff like that. But our federal government, by the way HUD defines homelessness, they, you know, they insist that people in communities that get HUD funding go out and every year count at the point in time count. And a lot of good people put a lot of tremendous effort into this, and I don't want to knock them at all. But HUD's restrictions on this count will not include the families that are staying in motels or doubled up with others, staying with other people. And that is really the bulk of our homeless population in this country. So HUD comes up with a number, and I'm not sure exactly, but I think the number is something like 637,000 people are homeless that were counted on that night.
Oh.
637,000. Now, let me just point to something, and I'll do a simple math here because that's the only kind I do. 1 million, almost 1 million, it's just a little under a million, were counted the year before last in the public schools identified as being in a homeless situation. 1 million kids, school-age kids, were identified. And any of us that have worked in this field know that there were probably another million that weren't counted because in some cases the families, they don't self-identify or the schools don't recognize it and all that. So, but just even think a million. And those a million school kids have younger siblings, probably, roughly speaking, 500,000.
Right.
And then you have the older teens that are maybe out of school, away from school, and they don't have parents in their lives or guardians, and they're out there on the streets. And those numbers, you know, range from anywhere from, you know, 1.5 million to 3 million or so. So just looking at the kids, and I didn't even add the parents in there, you know, so there's another 1 million parents in that. So you just kind of look at that. And that's why the homeless definition issue is so critical, because you have HUD going to Congress and saying, well, you know, it wasn't so bad. We just found 637,000 homeless people, and they're all pretty well those bum kind of guys out there anyhow. So don't worry about it. So Congress, of course, says, well, let's save our money on homelessness and let's spend it somewhere else, like some war or something like that. But, you know, so they make decisions based on these bogus numbers. And this has been going on year after year after year. So Congress has gotten pretty well used to not spending money addressing issues related to homelessness. And Congress and HUD has gotten a little touchy about us pushing to expand the definition, or actually not to expand it, but to bring it into sync with other federal definitions of homelessness that are reflective of reality. So you have a numbers game going on in Congress, and there's massive confusion. Those numbers, if you look at any stories referring to national homelessness numbers, you'll see that 637,000 or whatever pop up constantly. So we have terrible confusion on that.
I know just from being in this one county that there's got to be more. I mean, there's, I think, what, 63 or 64? I may be wrong. Counties or congressional districts in Florida. I don't know where I got that number, but I'm starting to get sleepy, so I'm just
getting to be that time. But
amount of children that have to be in this county, and then I try to just add it up for Florida. Oh my God, that's got to be a huge number. And then of course your major population centers are going to have more.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Tampa has become the largest metro area population-wise. It has surpassed the Miami area now.
Wow.
The largest metro area here in Florida. I think it's 8 counties, and a couple of them are pretty large, but it's a huge population center, Hillsborough County and Pinellas County, and I would say probably Sarasota and Manatee, huge, huge population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll be down there in a few weeks, so watch out. I'll add one more to the number.
Yeah, so the homeless, it's got to be a lot bigger than what they're saying. That's all I can say.
Oh, it is, yeah. That number is so insulting that, you know, I kind of sort of facetiously joke, and I know people will take this wrong, but it's like I could run over more people than that as I'm driving across the country that are homeless. I mean, it's just... You know, I see so many that are obviously homeless that are on the streets, and I talk to so many. And, you know, and then we have the families and the youth that really try to stay out of people's, you know, view. And they really are there trying to survive. And, you know, like this mom that I've been communicating by email with, you know, it's like you wouldn't know that she's homeless.
Right.
You know, her daughter's doing well in school, and, you know, but they struggle with it. You know, daughter just got strep throat the other day, and, you know, you just kind of go through that, and, you know, the logistics of having strep throat and living in a shelter that puts you out every morning at 7, and you just, you know, it's so wrong.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, and I can remember the 3 times I had strep throat. I didn't want to get up out of the bed, that's for sure. I think hospitalized once with that. So we're going into the last 12 minutes of the show, but I wanted to maybe get some feedback from you on where you see yourself in 5 years, and and what do you think you can accomplish with Hear Us in those years as well? And are you going to retire? Are you going to keep?
Yeah, well, you know, Anita, I've learned long ago that any kind of, you know, long-range planning, and for me 5 years is pretty long-range, it just has never worked for me. So I will just say, you know, my mother has asked me, she's 92 or going on 92, and she keeps asking me, well, you know, how long are you going to be doing this? And she's very supportive and very good, and I kind of go, I'll know when I need to stop. I don't know when I'm going to stop. I don't... You know, Hear Us doesn't have, you know, a five-year plan, you know, because it was always just kind of touch and go. And, you know, the resources, you know, tend to show up, but sort of, you know, it's nothing that's guaranteed. And so, you know, I think homelessness, sadly, is going to be around longer than probably I will be. But I would like to continue to use whatever energy I can do to, you know, develop that compassion epidemic as I travel and meet different people and, you know, touch different audiences. And, you know, I think the one audience that I really want to try to concentrate on, not solely, but really put some effort into it, is the, you know, the college and university audiences that are out there, because I've given presentations, you know, from, you know, across the country, Columbia University, you know, some really prominent schools, Oberlin College, and, you know, others, and I just am struck by the knowledge gap. There's not a lot of information in these higher education institutions about homelessness and poverty. There's getting to be a little bit more, but really when I talk to students and faculty, they look at me and they're absolutely astounded. So I think, you know, there's an audience there that needs to hear about these issues from, you know, people who know about it, and I'm more than happy to be, you know, among that little crowd, because, you know, I go in with my films, my own four walls, and On the Edge, and, you know, you cannot be blind to the issues after watching either or both of those films. So I'm looking forward to, you know, addressing more audiences, especially in higher education, and as long as I have a breath to breathe, that's probably what I'm going to be doing, as well as making more films.
Wow, I think that's great. And do you? What do you do when you need to just escape for a while? When you need to just chill out, relax? What's your favorite de-stressor?
Oh, thank you for giving me that opportunity to plug the wonderful sport of disc golf. Frisbee golf.
I've never heard of it.
People who don't know. It is played theoretically like a golf game, in the sense of, you know, you have holes. They're actually baskets, metal baskets with chains, and they're laid out in theory like a golf course, although it's a lot more rugged usually, or can be anyhow, and it's not, you know, fancy foo-foo. Sorry, golfers, but and it's free. Mostly, and it is played with a special kind of a frisbee type of thing, and people of all ages play it. I've been playing now for about 8 or 9 years, and I love the game. You get out, walk around. Sometimes you have to be a mountain goat, or sometimes the courses are pretty basic, and I get out, and I can do it by myself, or I've, you know, just kind of hook up with people that are playing on the course, and they're all real normal people out there, and we have a good time and get some fresh air and exercise, which I really desperately need now.
Yeah, well, that's it. When you're cooped up and you're driving a lot, you have to balance that with some moving about as well. And,
yeah.
And what are your travel plans for, like, say, the next 6 months? I know you're coming down here to Florida, but where else do you plan on going?
Well, 6 months is a pretty long-term plan there, but I'll take a shot at it. I am leaving the Atlanta area tomorrow morning early and heading to South Carolina, and from South Carolina I'll head down along the coast of Georgia. I'm hoping to connect with some people along the way and get some filming done. I'll probably swing through Jacksonville to see my friends there, and there's a disc golf course there that I didn't get to play last week when I was there, so I'm going back. And then I'll head down towards, you know, I might swing through, see my friends in the Gainesville area, and kind of hop around there, and I need to hit Orlando towards the end of March, going down to Port Charlotte, and I was even thinking that my high school over in Fort Lauderdale is going to invite me back. I haven't heard from them yet, so I'll just be doing a Florida, Georgia, South Carolina route for the next few weeks, and then I'll head up to, I've got some possibilities of presentations in Washington, D.C., in New York City, and then I need to head across to Illinois for the middle of April, and I'll be there for a few weeks, and then I head out again and take a sort of two-week vacation drive up in Canada, so I'm not technically going to be working, and I'll drive to Boston that route and do a conference at the end of May, and then June and beyond, I guess the end of June, I guess I'll be in Washington, D.C., so I'll have to sort of make some plans about that.
I think I'll be making some plans, too, for that.
Yeah.
I want to tell you, when you get up to Quebec and north of Quebec City, probably about an hour and a half out north, going north on the St. Lawrence River, there's a beautiful place called Bay St. Paul, which is an artist colony, and it's just absolutely, the views there are just breathtaking. So
I can't wait.
It's been a little plug. So if you're leaving Quebec City and driving north, there's a little village that's not on the map. It's called Capozois. The Cape of the Snow Goose, and that's where my mother's original ancestor landed and set foot in 1664.
Oh my gosh. Well, I probably will have to get back with you on the specifics on that. May seems like months and years away, but it'll be here fast, I know.
Absolutely. When you leave and go north, I mean, Quebec City itself is beautiful, but when you go north of there and just drive along the river, it is just, it'll take your breath away. It's so gorgeous. And there's like a road that goes to St. Lawrence, so you can, it's very hilly. It's very, very hilly and very, and there's another town, Les Ablemonts, that was actually the site of a huge meteor strike. Of course, you know, millions of years ago. And there's a little bed and breakfast that we stayed at that's supposed to be right on the rim of that meteor strike.
Well, that all sounds like it will be an interesting drive. And if we get lucky, I might even get to see the famous Pat LaMarche as I drive down through Bangor on my way to Boston. So who knows?
See the beluga whales too, right there in the Gulf of the St. Lawrence. They come up in the spring and summer.
Oh, okay. Well, you
there's
know,
not
I just,
too many of the belugas left, so they're a treat to see.
Well,
yeah.
I will certainly look forward to seeing whatever we can see, and I've got a good friend that travels with me on these little sojourns, so it's my vacation. It's 2 weeks of just kind of hanging loose and not hanging on the computer 24/7. So.
Right. Well, we're going into the last minute of the show, and I just wanted to thank our sponsors, which it's the Hoodoo blog, Roundtree 7, Here Be Monsters, and Daughters of Diane, I want to thank you very much for being on the show and telling us everything about what you're doing and what Hear Us is all about, and it was an amazing show, and it was amazing to get to know you even better. And we're really going to try and get over to Orlando to see you when you're there.
Great! That'd be great. I'm looking forward to, you know, swinging down that way, and I feel like, you know, I know you a little better now, and I love having friends all over, and you know, this show has been a wonderful opportunity for me to just kind of run at the mouth, but hopefully make it worthwhile for anybody that might be listening now or listening on the tape version later on.
So everybody, if you go to wisewomenmedia.posteris or blogspot, either one.com, I'll put the player there for you to listen to the archive. And we want to say good night, and thank you for listening to the Wise Women Media radio show on Here Be Monsters. And thanks, Diane. You have a great evening.
Well, thank you, Anita. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I will have a great evening because I'm going to hit the sack.
Okay, good night.
All right, night.